This week, our speaker is Libby Timmerman. Libby is a senior here at Pius and was born and raised in Lincoln, NE. She has five sisters and one brother. She is involved in campus ministry, pro-life club, Spanish club, track and cross country, discipleship, and currently leads a freshman encounter group. Libby plans to enter the health care field next year. In her free time, she likes walking her dog and playing pickleball. Please welcome Libby Timmerman.
Guys, thank you very much. Thank you. I don't know if you guys have seen the topic on the screens yet, but today we're going to be talking about courage. And I think this is such a huge thing because it is something that's more necessary than ever, and it's also something that's more lacking than ever in our youth today, especially in high schools. And I'm going to start off by talking about not about us, but about Great Britain in World War II. So in World War II, at the beginning, they were led by this guy named Neville Chamberlain. And Great Britain had just gotten done with World War I, and there was a lot of fighting and devastation, and they weren't trying to get into another war. And so because of this, in response, they decided to sign a policy of appeasement. And this meant that they took part of their land, and they said, you know what, Germany, you can have this little piece of ourselves, like, just then you don't have to take the rest of us. Essentially, they attempted to negotiate with a leader who showed that he had no respect for other countries' borders, but for some reason they were like, oh, but he's going to respect ours. Chamberlain was quoted by saying, the only thing that Nazi Germany understands is violence. So basically, Chamberlain knew who he was dealing with. He knew that this guy, that Adolf Hitler, was not respectable and didn't respect other people's borders. And Nazi Germany actually ended up invading anyway, and this agreement is now seen as cowardly. I think that the hardest part of being a Catholic teenager is the temptation to be like Great Britain. We try to compromise with the devil, and we say, you know what, I'm going to be good, but this part of my life, yeah, I can't like give it all in. So we compartmentalize our lives, and we say, that, you know, like, we say, like, this is who I am, I'm good, but, you know, like, when I'm around these certain people, or when I'm in these certain situations, then we make exceptions. But we know that this little piece of ourselves that we're giving to the devil, he won't be satisfied with just a little bit, and we won't be satisfied giving that to him. Because no matter how much territory you give the devil, he will just take more and more until he has your soul. We know who we're dealing with. And the thing is, the devil never promises us anything. And if he does, we know it's a lie, but we give into this temptation for little fleeting bits of happiness because we are too cowardly to acknowledge that when the pieces that we're giving into sin isn't making us happy, and we're too cowardly to make substantial changes in our lives. I think as high schoolers, we're really good at observing each other. We're really good at copying each other, you know, fitting into little like bubbles or boxes of what is acceptable, and we're really good at judging each other. It's hard to say what courage is, but I'll tell you what it is not. Courage is not conformity. We like doing things when they're easy. You know, we like to be good when it's easy to be good. You know, it's easy to work when you're motivated. It's easy to get out of bed when you're not tired. And it's easy to be nice when you like the person that you're being nice to. It's hard to say what courage is, but I will tell you what it is not. Courage is not easy. If you only love people when they love you, you don't love people, you love yourself. If you only obey scripture when you agree with it, you don't obey scripture, you obey yourself. And if you only worship God when he caters to you and when he answers your problems and when he makes you feel good, you do not worship God, you worship yourself. It's hard to say what courage is, but I'll tell you what it is not. Courage is not selfish. There are a lot of things that courage is not, but to sum it all up, courage is not comfortable. Even when I was preparing for this talk, I was overwhelmed with, like, really strong feelings of being unqualified. It was really hard for me to believe that I had something worth sharing. And even last night when I was at Charlie Bedell's talk at Restore, then I was just overcome by this word, insufficient. I feel insufficient. I kept, like, putting my hands out and saying, God, this is all I have, and it's nothing except for myself. And I didn't feel like that was enough. But the thing is, courage is not a feeling at all. It's what you do despite of how you feel. And in order to become courageous, we first have to overcome this lie that is very commonly accepted, that comfort is equal to happiness, and along with that, suffering is equal to misery. So there's this guy, and his name is Dr. Andrew Huberman, and he teaches neurobiology to med students. And he does this interview with David Goggins. If you don't know who David Goggins is, he's this guy who was a high school student. He was failing out of high school. He was incredibly unhappy. He was overweight, and he just really wanted to quit. He ended up becoming a Marine, I think, something in the military. I'm pretty sure it was a Marine, something really hard. Anyway, after he stopped becoming a Marine, he went on to do incredible things. Like, he ran this 100-mile race, like, with absolutely no training, which is really difficult. And basically, he just does a lot of things that make you uncomfortable. Anyway, in this interview, then Dr. Huberman talks about this area of your brain called the anterior mid-cingulate cortex. And if you look at this picture up there, it's that pink structure. And there's a lot of data in humans now that if you do things that you don't want to do, and that's the key, it's something that you do not want to do, then this area of your brain grows. It's not about adding more work. It's about adding more work that you don't want to do. And I think this goes for decisions as well. You know, like, just like sometimes there's hard decisions that you don't want to make. Like, when I'm driving to school with my sister, this is what it makes me think of. And I drive my sister to school, and because she has activities in the morning and I don't, and often I make her late, and I'm... Most days I'm driving to school and I'm thinking, you know, I really should apologize for, like, making her late, like, every day, just because I wanted to sleep, like, 5 minutes longer. And I sit with this decision, I'm like, oh, I don't want to apologize, and sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But during cross-country season, then one of our coaches, Tara, said the most powerful thing in the world is a decision. If you can imagine, running cross-country, you do a lot of things that you don't want to do. You know, you come back after a long practice and you look at your running watch and the step count. Shows you 20,000 things you didn't want to do. Courage in cross country looked like, you know, you are falling behind, and you thought the last step that you could take, you took that 2 miles ago, and you're still going. We often use the phrases, I don't feel like it, or I don't really want to, as, like, good excuses. Like, we just stay with how much we don't want to do, and that's sufficient enough to not do anything. And I'm telling you right now, this will never mentally satisfy you. The anterior mid-cingulate cortex can be grown throughout your lifetime. It is larger in athletes, it grows larger in those who are dieting and they decide not to eat a certain food, and it's especially large in those who see themselves as challenged or having overcome some challenge. And this is the crazy part about all of it. Scientists are starting to look at the anterior mid-cingulate cortex not just as the seat of the willpower, but as the seat of the will to live. This absolutely blew my mind. And it's hard to translate this into our own lives because it's almost backwards thinking to realize that pain might actually bring happiness and that maybe you're not actually happy because you're not suffering enough. Jesus calls us to deny ourselves and pick up our crosses. And I remember Father Schwenke said in a homily one time, it's so tempting and we often like to deny our crosses and pick up ourselves. We say, you've given me this suffering, Jesus, but I don't want it. I'm going to baby myself and I'm going to treat myself like a princess. Jesus also promises that if we entrust everything into him, he will satisfy us. And it's easy to think that everything is too much. We already have our lives sectioned off. You know, we have these borders that say, like, I'm sorry, I just can't give everything. Because the reality is that everything will hurt. If Christianity was something that we made up, we could make it a whole lot easier, but we didn't. Goggins responded to this information in this interview by saying, you are chained up because you don't want to find your willpower. Your soul, your will, your heart, your determination, your guts, and your courage. When I was asked to give this talk, I knew I didn't have enough experience of my own to provide all the answers. And so I called my sister Annie, and she's displaying a lot of signs of outward courage in her life right now. She graduated from college in May, and then in August she moved to Benque, Belize. And she's teaching there with a missionary group called SALT. And there's some pictures that she sent me of just, like, this country. It's absolutely beautiful. But I asked her, what is the most courageous thing you have done? And this was her response. Courage is often associated with adventure, and Belize has been full of it. I have climbed waterfalls, explored villages in Guatemala, hitchhiked, and ridden on the back of a motorcycle through forestry and train at speeds I was sure would kill me. But the most courageous thing I have done here is knowingly face pain for the sake of love. She explained that teaching was such a joy, and it made her so happy, but it's also a daily struggle. To give a little bit of background, these are also some more pictures that she sent me of her students. These kids would miss school some days because they were malnourished. They didn't have enough. They were just were not healthy enough because they didn't get a good amount of food to eat. Some of her kids would cut themselves. Some of her kids didn't want to go home for Christmas break because home wasn't a safe place for them. Because of like the hurt that these young kids were experiencing, they often didn't know how to deal with it because they were so young that they took this hurt out on other people. And so she talked about there was a lot of physical fights in the classroom. She would like pry kids out of headlocks. She faced a lot of disrespect, and she was really ignored and unheard. And she said, in these situations, I needed to love them not how they wanted to be loved, but how they needed to be loved. And it was hard because love looked like being reliable. It looked like being consistent and disciplined, being firm and being supportive. It takes a lot of courage to love without expecting anything in return, because the reality is the value of love does not depend on reciprocation. We have this romanticized version of love. You know, we watch too many movies and we're only motivated to love when we are loved by someone or when we feel loved. Love is what you do in spite of what you feel. Love is fighting for the good of someone, even if they never see the sacrifice that you did to get love to them. When Jesus died on the cross, it did not feel good. He wasn't like, you know, oh, the way they put that nail in there. Like, no, that hurt. Love sometimes hurts. We do not understand the love that we are recipients of because we cannot fully comprehend the level of pursuit it took to get to us. Halfway through the school year, two of Annie's students stopped showing up. This wasn't super uncommon, but her and one of her coworkers decided to go check it out. They didn't have an address, they just had a general city. This is kind of how things worked down there, but they took an hour walk, and finally they got to like the general area, and they were asking people around like to give them further instructions. And they just got closer and closer, and they asked some neighbors, and the neighbors pointed them to where their house was. Their house was inaccessible by car, so they kind of had to check up this little hill, this rocky terrain. Their house was built into the side of the hill. It was held up by wooden planks. It had a tin roof with holes in it, and the rooms were separated by bed sheets. It turned out that the brother was sick. He had been poisoned by some tree, which also wasn't extremely uncommon. And the girl had a relative who had been financially supporting her through school, and he had walked out on them. And walking into this level of brokenness, I was listening to this voice my sister sent me, and you could just hear the brokenness in her voice. Just like loving these kids so much and seeing their poverty, and it was the most painful and heartbreaking thing to experience for her, especially when there's little to nothing that could be done for them. Love isn't always pretty. When Annie came home for Christmas, she talked about Belize like the country owned her heart. When I asked her what surprised her the most about her time there, she said, "I did not realize how much I could love." At this point, she had not showered with warm water for 5 months. She hadn't been fed well at all, and she had been worked harder than ever before. But all we saw was joy and happiness that was only obtained through suffering. She said, "By far the craziest adventure has been loving these kids, and it takes so much courage when I know it's going to hurt to get beat down and get up and do it again and again and again." I think it's easy to think that courage is this big, it's loud and it's bold and it's only experienced by like the strong and the chosen. But courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is the small voice in the back of your head at the end of the day that says, "I'll try again tomorrow." So a large portion of my high school has been trying to be a bare minimum Catholic. I'm the fifth of seven kids, and in my community, especially at St. Teresa's, and like the Timmerman name was already well known by the time I got there. You know, all these teachers already had my perfect siblings ahead of me. And so this taught me to live up to the standards of my siblings, and then after that, I had built this kind of reputation. I had the mentality that I could do whatever I wanted to. As long as people thought a certain way about me, then I didn't actually have to be that person. I could do and I could say whatever I wanted to, as long as I was happy in that moment. Essentially, I did a lot of conforming, especially in high school, and I did things for my own gain. I looked like an average Catholic, but I had no relationship with God for a large part of my high school. During my junior year, I found my friends and just like the people who were kind of like my home. And I was really happy when I was like being with people and when I was active and when I had these distractions, but on my own, I felt empty. There was just this big hole I felt, like this lack of contentment, and I almost felt like I didn't even know myself. Like, the voice in my head that was speaking, I didn't even recognize it, and I didn't even want to listen to it. In April of 2023, then I was journaling in my prayer journal because I really like to journal and just write, help me organize my thoughts. I wrote this. This was the spring of last year. Lately, I've been weak. I feel chained down by my addictions, controlled by my desires like they own me. The constant restlessness inside is drowning me. I want less, and I need to suffer more. This night, I think it was during Restore, then I specifically asked God for three things, and this was something that was new to me because before this, like, I was really worried that the Catholic faith wasn't real, and, like, what did it mean if Jesus wasn't real? I don't know if you guys have ever stopped and thought about that, but I was like, what then? Like, I don't know what to do. All these things that I'm putting my life into, what if it's not real? What if I die and nothing happens? Like, so I was scared if I asked God for something and he didn't do anything about it, and this, like, what I asked for, like, I didn't get, then that meant that God wasn't real and God isn't there. So I never asked for anything. I would pray and I'd say, hey, like, I'm praying for, like, my mom, or I'm praying for the cross country season, but I didn't say, like, make a specific request. But this night, I asked for three things. First of all, I said, Jesus, I want to feel something, because along with this, like, discontent, I also just kind of felt numb. Like, I didn't know myself. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I wanted to feel, like, actually feel. This big one that I asked for is I asked for peace, you know. Just, this was the main thing that I was struggling with, is I just didn't feel peaceful, and I hadn't felt content in a long time. And the last thing I asked for is I said, Jesus, come dance with me. And this might be confusing, but I come from a very musical family. We like to sing and we like to dance, and I'm also a very visual person. And so a lot of times when I'm distracted during prayer and I don't have any words to give Jesus, then I would close my eyes. And in my head, then me and Jesus would just dance. And a lot of times then I didn't have any words to explain, like, how I was feeling. And sometimes I didn't even know myself. But when me and Jesus were dancing, then all these emotions and all these, like, feelings that I was really feeling, like, they would come out. You know, sometimes I would cry when I didn't even realize I was upset, and then I could, like, go with that. Shortly after this Restore, then I mentally detached myself from any association with God, and I was tired of living a double life, and I said, you know, I'm just going to give up. I didn't pray or even address God for the next 3 months. I did the Catholic things, but I was really just going through the motions. That July came, and I realized I was signed up for the Steubenville Youth Conference. And so this is basically where a bunch of kids go to, I think it was like Missouri, you know, you take buses out, and you have talks, and you have adoration, and you have small groups, and all these good things. At this point, I was so numb from trying to hide my shame, my cowardness, and my pride, that I wasn't planning on getting anything out of it. I was happy that my friends were going. There was probably going to be maybe some good food. Excited for the bus ride. The day before I left, I went to work. I worked at Genesis Health Clubs as front desk. And so I went in, I clocked in, and one of my coworkers said, Libby, the manager needs to speak to you in his office. And I was like, bro, what? Like, I didn't even know who this manager was. I don't think I could even tell you his name at that point. And so I went to his office, and he said, Libby, I'm sorry to be telling you this, but you're getting fired. And this was a shock to me. I was like, this is crazy, because I don't know, I was really taken by surprise. And he was like, you need to sign this paper. I didn't really know what I was signing. I know I probably didn't want to be signing it. And he said, I'm also just the messenger. The boss is gone today. And so he just told me that you're getting fired. The only explanation I have for you is that you're not doing your job well enough, but I can't really explain anything further than that. I proceeded to cry for an hour in the office of a manager who I barely knew. I remember being, like, pretty embarrassed. I was really frustrated because I couldn't even talk. Like, I was so upset that I was trying to logically think through, okay, this is not that big of a deal. But every time I'd open my mouth, I would just start, like, I'd try to ask a question, and I'd just start crying again. And I realized that I had this big tower of perfectionism and, like, this idea of who I was, and it just crumbled because I was kind of like I wasn't. As soon as I calmed down enough, I signed this paper, and I quickly left the building, hoping that I would never, ever come back. I was burdened with a lot of questions and confusion. And so I went to Steubenville the next day with the mentality that I was going to put it all behind me. I was going to forget about it, and this would, like, take the pain away. And it did for short periods of time, but it would always come back. One of the talks that we had at Steubenville was about this nun. It was just a woman's talk. There was a bunch of girls in this arena, and she was talking about she was driving somewhere, and this cop pulled her over. She thought she was doing nothing wrong, but this cop pulled her over, and she was really mad about it because she was like, I don't think this deserves a ticket. Anyway, she got to where she was going, and she heard God ask her, why do you view me as a cop? Why do you view me as this person who's just always out to get you and catch you in your mistakes? And we met in small groups after this talk, and they asked us, what is God asking you? Because this is really just shows you more of a reflection on who you are, of just like how you view Jesus and not who Jesus is, because Jesus is so good. At first, I tried to force an answer. I was trying to think like, oh, like, I don't know. I just wanted to contribute something. Like, cool, everyone was saying some really nice things. But I was going to say like, oh, Jesus is asking me to trust him more, but I ended up just staying quiet. And my mind started to drift. And that's when I heard him say, why don't you dance with me anymore? And at this moment, I felt so called out for my priorities and for where I had been. And I was just like, wow, yeah. I don't know. I sat with that a little bit. But after that, then we actually had a mosh pit outside. There was like, it was outside and it was in the sun. And there was a ton of kids from all over the state. And we danced and there was a dance party. And so basically, I forgot about everything. Later that night, we had 3 hours of adoration and exposition of the Blessed Eucharist. In the talk before the exposition, then they talked about Christ's wounds. They talked about taking shelter in Christ's wounds and then also taking our wounds and asking Jesus to enter into them. And it's really hard for me to admit, even to myself, when I'm not doing okay, because pain is not pretty. And I just spent so much of my time trying to make everyone, like, make it seem that my life was perfect when it wasn't, that it took me a lot of courage to even bring up getting fired. It was just this really low in this dark moment, and it brought a really low and dark feeling inside of me. It wasn't just this specific failure in my life, but it was the buildup of the weight of the standards I had set and this false reputation that I had, at least with myself, that had crumbled. All these lies I was telling myself about who I was, and I was believing them. And I was telling myself that I was okay for so long that when I realized I wasn't, I didn't know what to do. I felt so lost. So in this office, back when I was getting fired, I was trying so hard not to cry. I was like trying to keep it all in and bottle it up, you know, try to be professional. Just trying to get control of myself. And I walked out into the parking lot and I like had my head down. I was trying to get to my car. I got to my car. I sat down and I just sobbed. Like it was all this sadness from inside of me that I didn't, it was so hard to keep it in. And so I just let it all out. And the thing that really got me, I remember I was really upset about what had just happened, but the thing that really got me is that I realized, you know, it's like one of the things you say to yourself that you don't try to say, but it's just the truth. The truth came out. I said, I'm so unhappy. I'm so unhappy. And I'm telling you, it is cowardice that keeps us, chained up into our unhappiness. You know, the devil doesn't want you to be happy. There's so much disappointment, especially myself, lack of self-worth. I realized I didn't even respect myself anymore, and there's just so much raw pain. There's something about crying, you know, like, I feel like people, you know what it's like to cry, but to hear yourself cry, like, I had never cried out loud like that I could remember. And hearing the pain in my own voice, you know, it was just something that I couldn't even put into words, but I could hear it so clearly. So the Eucharist was exposed, and I asked Jesus to enter into that moment of desolation. Yeah, I closed my eyes, and I was back in that car when I was so lost and so alone, and Jesus was sitting next to me in the passenger seat. And I was like, okay, this is chill. He gets out of the car, and that for a second, I was like, why is he leaving me? I felt, like, scared for a second, but Jesus opened the car door. He walked around the car, and he opened up my door, and he had his hand out like this, and I took it. And he took me into the parking lot, and he danced with me. And in this moment, I felt awe for a God who could love me enough to hate the things that hurt me without hating me for causing them. He didn't condemn me. He didn't judge me. He just held me and said, Libby, welcome home. Jesus begs us to come to him in our misery, and he promises he will make us a new creation, and he will transform our sufferings. There is such a fulfillment in the life with Christ. It's hard to explain, but the thing that I can just say the best is everything is more beautiful. The far retreat, then Mrs. Molly said, sin doesn't make you bad, it makes you dead, like your soul is actually dying when you sin. And to have a soul that is so alive, it's the most freeing feeling ever. When I came back from Steubenville, I still had some questions, and so I called my boss and asked if he had some time to just talk about, you know, what happened, because he wasn't there when I got fired, and this was ultimately his decision. He asked me to come in, like actually drive to his office, and so I went back to Genesis. I parked and I got out of the car, and I thought that I would feel so weak in that parking lot where I had last had one of my lowest lows, but instead I felt strong. There was this strength inside of me I wasn't expecting. I went to his office and we talked about it, and he decided that it was actually just a big miscommunication, and he offered me the job back. Throughout my time at Steubenville, I realized that Genesis wasn't making me happy anymore. It wasn't a good place for me, and I was involving myself with people who were bringing me into some bad situations. And so I explained this to him, and he was super understanding, and what he left me with is he said, Libby, he said this over and over, protect your peace. Protect your peace. And after months of feeling restless and, like, hiding, to hear protect your peace, after I was just turning my life around and I had found real peace, it was just, like, it was just what I needed to hear. I got up and I was about to leave, and he said one last thing. First of all, I'm going to take your paperwork and I'm going to submit it as that you resigned due to the upcoming school year. And then he took my piece of paper that I had signed 3 days earlier, and I could see my name on it where I had signed earlier, where my name, Elizabeth Timmerman. And it was almost like who I was at that point, and he ripped it up. He physically tore it up, and that visual representation of someone who I was and someone who I was going to leave behind me was just super powerful. Jesus answered every one of my prayers because I found the courage to ask him. We're often too cowardly to even ask Jesus for what we want, and I opened up about my pain. There's this quote I really like, and it says, sometimes when you're in a dark place, you think you have been buried, but you have actually been planted. This pain was just a seed of someone better who I could become. I decided to make changes in my life, and I gained so much through this new piece in my life. I decided to implement discipline. I decided to figure out who I was, and I wanted to recognize the voice speaking inside of my head, and so I spent some time alone, and I built up this confidence by consistently keeping the promises I made to myself, and I built a reputation with myself through God so that I could trust myself. I stopped being so concerned about my reputation with other people because I stopped looking at myself through the eyes of people who never saw me. This would have never happened if I hadn't found the courage to look inside my own self and notice the distance between me and God. Jesus wants to fulfill you, but he is waiting for you to dare to ask. In John 14:13, Jesus says, ask anything in my name and I will give it to you. Do you want to come to the end of your life and say, well, Jesus, you didn't give me very much? And he'll say, you didn't ask for very much. So where do we go from here? Courage sounds intimidating. It's something so huge to try to tackle something extraordinary. Trying to tackle something extraordinary is super hard, or making any big change in your life, because motivation, no matter how big it is, it always runs out. You can't rely on motivation. And so what I'd say start by cleaning your room. Organize your local environment. That's probably not something you want to do. Make your bed, schedule your time, start taking control of yourself. See if you can stop saying things that you know to be lies, even if it's just the dialogue in your own mind, because what you think is way more powerful than you really can even imagine. What you think becomes what you say, and what you say becomes what you do. I'll finish off with this story that there's a boy and this horse, and they go into the woods. And the boy says, I can't see a way through. And the horse says, well, can you see your next step? The boy says, yes. And so the horse says, just take that. Track season has just started, and a lot of times they'll give us, like, our run. Like, you have to run this, like, 4-mile route or whatever. And it's easy to think, I don't think I can do that. I don't think I can do 4 miles right now, especially not at the pace that we're setting. And so I tell myself, Libby, can you take the next step? Yes, I can take the next step, so just take that. Just take the next step in front of you. It's not about how big that step is. We try to make big leaps at one time, and it's too much. It's about what direction that step is going. Release yourself from your shame, your cowardness, and your selfishness, and find the courage to take just one step. Thank you.